gentleman. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, along with co-host.
I'm Julia Minton.
And her mic number two needs to be on.
Hi.
You're still Julia Minton.
Now I'm a very loud Julia Minton.
All right. Well, great. Julia, we've got a great guest on the line.
Oh, I'm so excited.
And for this episode of Thinking Clearly, really looking forward to this conversation. Well, what's the topic for tonight?
Oh, tonight's topic is the importance of critical thinking and some interactive resources for sharpening your critical thinking skills.
And our guest, Spencer Greenberg, has a PhD in mathematics with a specialty in machine learning and engages with a variety of interests and projects. For example, he's the founder and CEO of Sparkwave, which is described as a startup foundry that creates new software companies from scratch designed to help solve big problems in the world. And in this episode of Thinking Clearly, we're going to focus on one of those organizations called Clearer Thinking, which states as its mission, quote, to close the gap between insights from research about human behavior and actions in the real world. And it goes on to say, we build best-in-class interactive tools and mini courses that you can use to change your habits, make better decisions, and achieve goals. Spencer, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Fantastic. We mentioned, could you give us a quick tour of how you went from grad school in applied mathematics to forming Sparkwave, and then on to your other projects, including your work with helping computer-assisted tools for improving critical thinking?
Sure, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I did my PhD in applied math at NYU, and I studied machine learning, or AI, which is basically the study of how to make accurate predictions using data. But really, my goal was never to be in academia. I knew that I wanted to use technology to try to improve people's lives. And so that's why I then founded Sparkwave, which is what I do now, where, as you mentioned, we build new software companies with the goal of helping solve big problems in the world. For example, we created a product called Uplift, which is for helping people who are suffering from depression, and another product called Mindies, which is for helping people manage their anxiety symptoms. And these are apps you can actually download now in the app stores if you want to check them out. But another project that we created is called Clearer Thinking. And Clearer Thinking we actually created as a not-for-profit project where, as you can see, all the tools on our website are totally free, and we just created them for the public benefit. And the focus of the site is really to try to help people make better decisions, understand the world more clearly, and hone their thinking.
Just to get a little bit of idea about how you went from graduate school, a lot of people that go to graduate school, they're going to go on and do research, or they're going to, you know, become professors at a university, or they're going to go out and make a lot of money for a business that's already started. But it sounds like you took a path less traveled. And I'm wondering, I've heard another podcast where you mentioned effective altruism. Was that an important link to be engaged with your work doing things that are going to benefit the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, for me, I like to think about what are the sort of powerful tools that I can learn that then I can apply in the world. And so to me, I've spent my life studying mathematics, computer science, machine learning, psychology, experimental design. But for me, these always have been a means to an end, that I want to use these things so that I can make a difference in the world. And so the subject of effective altruism, that's a very interesting one to me, because effective altruism is a community of people that are trying to figure out, how do we do the most good with our time or with our money? And if we have different things that we could spend our money or time on, how do we kind of prioritize them? Because there's so many different things you can do to try to help the world. And so that is a topic I'm extremely interested in. And it's always sort of how I've thought about using these different tools like math and computer science. And so that's sort of been the focus of my life.
I spent quite a bit of time actually, on Clearer Thinking, looking at some of the courses and going through them. I completed about 10 of them.
Wow, that's a lot. I'm impressed.
Yeah, I think there's 39 of them by my last count. You keep adding them. The header on the homepage reads, quote, upgrade your life, thrive in a complete world using science-based tools.
In a complex world, yes.
Thank you. Julia catches all my mistakes. These tools and modules, I call them modules, you call them tools and mini courses, range from helping users to improve their moods, like you said, to one of my favorites, which was designed to help us recognize our biases and spot our faulty arguments. So if you can talk a little bit more about tools, especially ones that would help our critical thinking listeners, and describe how the tools were designed and tested. And then after you do that, I really want to get into the two tools that have to do with Bayes' theorem and talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's one of my favorite topics, Bayes' theorem. So, yeah, absolutely. So we build tools that cover basically six broad topic areas. The first is helping you understand yourself. And so, for example, we have a program called the How Rational Are You test. It's actually one of the most popular things we've ever created. Hundreds of thousands of people have completed that test. And what it does is it asks you a number of questions where each question is linked to a common bias. And then at the end of the test, you get a report that analyzes which biases you may be more susceptible to. Another topic area we cover is on understanding the world. And so for that, we have tools like our common misconception test. That one is really fun because it gives you 15 common misconceptions, but it also gives you 15 things that seem like they might be common misconceptions, but that are actually true. And you have to actually try to figure out which of them are true and which of them are false. And to make it more interesting and cognitively demanding, we turn into a betting game where we give you points and you have to actually bet how confident you are, based on how confident you are about the different questions. And so we can actually use that data to analyze whether you tend to be overconfident or underconfident. The third topic area is in improving your mood. So we have a program called Building Happiness Habits, where we try to get you to link things in your everyday environment to positive mental habits like gratitude. The fourth topic area is making better decisions. So one of my favorite tools is the Decision Advisor, where if you're dealing with a really thorny big life decision, you can just load up the Decision Advisor and it will walk you through a systematic process for helping you make that decision. The fifth topic area is accomplishing your goals. And so we have a program that we actually just released recently called Daily Ritual, which is a system to help you create new daily habits in your life, whether you want to exercise more or start a meditation habit or what have you. And the final category is recognizing faulty logic. And so we have programs there like this pretty new program we made called Can You Detect Weak Arguments? Where we actually give you a number of real world arguments people have made for different topics like gun control or whether video games cause violence. And you have to actually say how strong or weak these arguments are.
That was one of my favorites. That's the top of my list. I love that one.
Oh, thanks. So those are the broad areas we cover. And you also asked, so how do we develop these tools? Well, originally, the motivation for clear thinking was that we saw all of these really interesting insights being developed in the academic world, but many of them were either not trickling down to people to benefit their lives, or maybe they would learn about them in a book or blog post, but they would have trouble actually adapting them to their lives. And so we had this idea, well, what if we make interactive tools that help you actually apply these concepts to your life directly? And then as time has progressed, we've started to do more and more of our own original research where we're actually running our own studies. We generally run studies on almost every program that we make. And then increasingly, we've started to run randomized control trials, actually testing the effects of some of our programs. So that's been a really interesting development as well.
Take a few minutes to tell us about the Bayes' theorem and how critical thinkers would actually use that as a critical thinking tool.
Yeah, so this is such an interesting one, an important one. And as a mathematician, I love it because Bayes' theorem is actually a concept for mathematics. And what's so fascinating about it is actually a mathematical theorem that tells us the strength of evidence. So I think a lot of times, you know, people debate about a topic and maybe they learn a fact and they don't know necessarily, like, is that fact strong evidence for my belief? Is it weak evidence? Is it moderate evidence? But the mathematics of Bayes' theorem actually answers this question. And so I feel like it should be much more well known than it is because it answers this incredibly important question about the strength of evidence. And so it's quite hard to understand for most people if they just stare at the formula. So what we like to do is we like to teach it by turning it into English. And there's actually an English language phrase that describes how strong evidence is. So suppose that you have some hypothesis and you get a piece of evidence for the hypothesis, then the English language phrase you want to ask yourself is, how many times more likely am I to see this evidence if my hypothesis is true compared to if it's not true? And so again, I'll say that again because it's pretty complicated. how many times more likely am I to see this evidence if my hypothesis is true compared to if it's not true? And if the answer is that it's just as likely to be seen if your hypothesis is true as then if it's not true, then it's not evidence at all. It doesn't tell you anything. On the other hand, if you're many more times more likely to see this evidence if your hypothesis is true than if it's not true, then that means that it's strong evidence in favor of your hypothesis. On the other hand, if you're many times less likely to see this evidence if your hypothesis is true than if it's not true, then it's actually evidence against your hypothesis. And so this can be applied in almost any situation when you have a belief and you get some new evidence about it. So for example, let's say you think that a certain politician is the best person to vote for given your values. But then you uncover the fact that they've supported a bill that you thought was a really bad bill. Right? So this is evidence, and then you can ask yourself, well, how many times more likely would I be to see them vote for this in favor of this bill if indeed this person was the best candidate according to my values compared to if they were not? And so that's an example of how you might apply it.
It's a really good explanation, because we've certainly talked about Bayesian reasoning before.
Yeah, we've talked about it before, and I want to emphasize that I think it's important, if you really want to get into this approach and really understand it, that you do look at those modules, the two modules.
The question of evidence is a module we made that's about Bayesian thinking,
yes.
And it teaches you how to apply this idea.
Right.
And then the other one you mentioned is it's called Can You Detect Weak Arguments? And it helps you practice looking at arguments, saying, is that a strong argument? Is that a weak argument? And all of this can be found, it's all free, and it can all be found at clearerthinking.org.
Which, yeah. I got to say, is a great name.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Love the name of your radio show.
I know. We'll have to see who got that name first. But
good question.
That name's batted around with several different uses. But at any rate, what I wanted to say is that I think it's worth any critical thinker to actually get into this Bayesian concept, because if it doesn't do anything else for you, it will get you to appreciate base rates.
Mm.
That's base rate neglect is one of the things that people do all the time. What's the initial probability of a theory or a medical test or being true? In other words, if the incidence of cancer is only 1 in 10,000, a certain type of cancer, and you get a test for cancer, it's very important to know that initial statistic there of what the incidence of cancer is. So it'll get you to appreciate that. And I want to say it's mathematical, but it's just the formula itself. You can use it with only addition, subtraction, fractions, and that kind of thing. It's not calculus.
No, and you can use a reasoning approach. I was really enjoying exploring some of the tests myself. I most recently took a Discover Your Reasoning Style. And
nice.
Yeah, I'll say to no surprise, I came up a skeptic, but
surprising.
But I did learn quite a bit about myself that, for instance, my future-based reasoning score was not as high as I thought it would be. So in some ways, you know, I saw that it seemed to make sense for my personality type, but it still was very revealing about my reasoning style. So this is, you know, one of the many tools that is free on your website, Clearer Thinking. And I didn't see, you know, any ads or pop-ups or any of that annoying stuff I'm used to on the rest of the internet. How do you monetize this site? How do you make it work?
Yeah, so the answer is we don't monetize the site. We really created it as a public service because we just believe so much in the importance of trying to help people think more clearly, trying to help them make better decisions. So whereas some of our other products we make are for profit, and we do sell them, for the entire Clear Thinking site was really not designed for that purpose. It's really just designed to help people.
Awesome.
And Julia said that she came out lower on future predictions. So you have a site that's called Calibrate Your Judgment, right?
Yeah. That
would be the next module for her.
Yeah. So Calibrate Your Judgment is a really cool one. And we actually teamed up with a not-for-profit that we worked with to build that. And basically what it is it gives you lots of probabilistic prediction practice. I didn't mean to have so much alliteration there, but basically we give you lots of questions and you have to estimate the probability of the thing being true. But these are questions where the answer is already known. So then we can immediately score you. So if you say, oh, I think it has a 95% chance of it being true, but then it's false, you actually lose a ton of points because you were so confident and wrong. And so you can actually practice. And we literally have thousands of examples you can practice on in that tool. So you, if you want, you can spend hours honing your skills and you can really learn to make much better probabilistic judgments. And I'm glad you brought that up because I think one of the most important thinking skills of all in the world is trying to avoid binary thinking. So rather than thinking of things as being true or false, instead, thinking in terms of probabilities, thinking that's very likely true. It's a 90% chance of being true. It's a 70% chance of being true. And that thinking skill is just one of the most core critical thinking skills that all other thinking skills are built on. And it comes in other forms as well. Very often people think in binary terms about good and bad too. They think, well, nuclear power is bad or nuclear power is good. When in fact, nuclear power is a mix of good and bad, as almost everything is. Now, you might think that in the end, it's more good than bad or more bad than good. But to not accept that there's good and bad and that there's bad and good is really limits one's ability to think clearly.
On this show, we have our own working definition and much longer description of critical thinking. What's yours?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because it's, you know, critical thinking, it's really hard to define. And there's so many different definitions people use. I actually once found this list. I think there were like 10 or 15 definitions that different people use. But I'll tell you the definition that I prefer, which is that critical thinking is the art of processing information in such a way as to lead to true conclusions. So really, it has to be about the ways of thinking that lead to the truth. Because merely being critical or skeptical, if it doesn't lead to the truth, it's not actually a better form of thinking. And so that's why I emphasize the kind of truth aspect of it.
How about those folks that would take that advice and go to their favorite wacko website and think they're really getting the truth?
Well, that's the danger, is that we have a natural tendency to take our beliefs as true, as given. So it's very interesting to think about times in our past when we've changed our mind, because most of us have had some really important big belief that we changed our mind about. And yet, when we think about the beliefs we hold today that we're just as confident in, we kind of assume we're never going to change our mind, that we're probably not wrong about any of them. So while many people talk about, oh, I have the truth, or this is the truth, it doesn't mean that their beliefs are any more likely to be true than other people's. However, I deeply believe that there are ways of thinking that tend to lead more to true conclusions, and there are other ways of thinking that tend to lead to more false conclusions. As an example, if you, let's say, accept whatever truths your parents tell you, well, that could be good if your parents believe a lot of true things, or it could lead you astray if they believe a lot of false things. But certainly, you're not going to end up believing more true things than your parents if you drop that strategy. So that's not the best strategy for figuring out the truth. You can learn from your parents, but you shouldn't just automatically believe everything your parents tell you. So that's just to illustrate the point that there are some ways of figuring out what's true that work better and other ways that work worse. And so to me, critical thinking is about those ways of thinking that tend to more reliably lead to true conclusions.
I hope my dad's not listening.
I don't mean to offend parents, but...
No. It's a very good point. So earlier in our introduction, we mentioned that your software company, Sparkwave, is there to facilitate solving big problems in the world. And some of that work aims at trying to help us be better critical thinkers. And in making a software company, you certainly could have tried to explore being the next big Uber or something. But give us your take on why it's important at this time in our cultural development for us to become better at learning and using critical thinking in that direction.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, the thing that I think about is that if you lived 20,000 years ago, the kind of decisions you'd make in your life were, first of all, much simpler than the kind of decisions that we make today. You know, you didn't have to decide what to do with your 401k. You know, you didn't need to decide which dating apps to sign up for and how to choose a mate. You probably would live with 50 or 100 people for most of your life, and life was much simpler. Not only that, but our brains were evolved over millions of years, and they evolved for certain kinds of environments, the sort of environments that we tended to live in. Whereas in the modern world, we're sort of outside the range of what our brains were evolved to be able to handle really well. So I think that we're now shoved into a world where we're having to make these incredibly complicated decisions all the time, and it's actually really hard to figure out what to do. The world's really complex. The truth is difficult to see. And the more we can understand what's true, it can help us better plan to help us achieve our personal goals and to help us achieve the goals that we have for the world. But I'll also add to that, that I think the stakes get even larger when we think at a broader scale. Because today, with this incredibly connected world we have, and with the advanced technology we have, the decision of one person can actually affect thousands or millions or in some cases even billions of different people. So the stakes have gotten so high and the world is so complex that I think now more than ever, it's incredibly important that we learn to think really clearly so that we can make good decisions. And, you know, so take, you know, the example of the COVID-19 virus, right? That was a really complicated challenge looking at that and saying, well, how bad is this going to get? What can we do to stop it? And it's still highly debated and still people don't agree. And I think in a world where we were better trained in rational thinking, I think we would be able to answer questions like that faster, develop better plans to solve the problem more rapidly, and basically be able to protect the world better and make a better world in general. So that's kind of how I think about it.
We've talked quite a bit on this show about biases, and a few of your modules get into that. I've looked a little bit at the debiasing literature on debiasing mm-hmm. interventions, but both debiasing interventions and critical thinking training in general seems like there's pretty strong resistance from that. You talked about 20,000 years ago, our evolutionarily entrenched biases like confirmation biases and the heuristics that we have evolved. And our use of the fast intuitive system one thinking that we've talked quite a bit about on this show. And there are studies also showing that when people do get trained to either in debiasing or critical thinking in general, that learning isn't very transferable from one domain to another. So you can learn about all these things in a statistics class and then go to a political science class, and it's as if you never understood them in the first place. So with these challenges in mind, what do you see as a future for human beings being able to effectively remedy these evolutionary limitations?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I think the first thing I think it's important to understand about that is that everything that we call cognitive bias was created by evolution and had a particular purpose. And it probably served a survival purpose at one point in history. And in many cases, it might still serve us today. So let me give you an example. Take the example of the recency effect, where we weight recent information more than more distant information. So for example, suppose that you just happened to hear yesterday that a plane blew up on the runway. Right now, you might have that example in your mind that weighing on you when you're trying to decide whether to take a flight or, let's say, take a train somewhere. Whereas if you had heard that information a year ago or 10 years ago, it would be much less likely to weigh on you. Now, that can actually lead to a bias because you might overweight that information. In fact, that's an incredibly rare event and it's not really something you should worry about, but it's, you know, because it just happened, you might overweight it. So it seems like a bias. But on the other hand, you know, if you lived 20,000 years ago and you saw a tiger at the watering hole yesterday, then that information actually might be much more important than if you saw the tiger at the watering hole a month ago, because maybe that actually is much less likely to predict that the tiger is going to be there again today. So the first point I want to make is just that these things that we call biases, they are there for a purpose, and we really have to differentiate between cases where they're helping us and cases where they're getting in our way. And it's really cases where they happen to get in our way that those are the ones we want to try to correct. So that means that to do better, you have to not just know about biases, but you have to know when they're problematic, because they're not always going to be problematic. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is that very often, in order to work on correcting a bias, you have to really get it to the level of pattern recognition, where you start noticing in your everyday life the patterns that indicate that bias might be occurring, and have that thought at that right moment in your life, hey, I might be falling for the sunk cost fallacy, or I might be falling for the planning fallacy, or whatever. And if you don't have that thought at the right moment, it doesn't matter if you learned about it in the class, because you're not going to be able to solve your problem. So the sunk cost fallacy one is an interesting example, because that's a fallacy many people fall into, including myself sometimes, where when you're working on a project and you've already invested a lot of time or resources into it, and you're trying to decide whether to keep working on it, we often weigh all of that prior investment and we don't want to stop a project because we've put so much into it, even if the future prospects of it actually are not worth it anymore. And so if you know about the sunk cost fallacy, that only helps you if at that moment when you're thinking about, should I stop this project, you actually have the thought, hey, this might be the sunk cost fallacy. I know what to do when I have the sunk cost fallacy. I need to just consider the future and only consider whether the additional incremental effort is worth what I'm going to get in the future, and I need to completely ignore any past expenditure. So I think bringing that pattern recognition to the problem actually can really help. And the last thing I'll say about this is that I'm really excited about this idea of so one thing you can do is you can bring the bias, the knowledge of the bias to the person at the right moment. And we've been trying to do that in some of our tools. For example, the Decision Advisor tool, which you can find on clearthinking.org, what that does is when you're making a big life decision, it walks you through the process and actually teaches you about biases that are relevant to the decision you're making. And what's really cool about that is that instead of learning about a bias and then hopefully 6 months later remembering it when you need it, it actually teaches you about the bias at the moment you're making that big life decision.
You know, I've often said that wisdom is always remembering those things that we really know. So we can know about these biases, but we get emotionally invested in situations and beliefs and that kind of thing. How then can we actually get ourselves to remind ourselves about the bias and challenge it?
Yeah, so and that's largely why we create the programs in the way that we do, or we make them interactive and we give lots and lots of examples, because I think a key element of that is seeing many different examples of that bias in different situations that are realistic. So not just, you know, a formulaic problem like a math, like a, you know, sort of math problem you might have where you have to solve the problem, but more realistic situations where you have to think, well, how does that apply to that situation? Well, what about that? And if you see enough of those, then your brain can start to generalize and start to notice it when you're going about your day. So that's the hope.
In my emailing with you, I mentioned a piece of research by Kerry Moorridge from Boston University, and we're hoping to get him as a guest on this show in the future. He and his colleagues took about, I don't know, 4 years or so to come up with a computer game, which was debiasing training, and they actually have several papers out, claiming to have some pretty good success with that in treating, in debiasing 6 common biases. And the title, I'm going to post this on our Facebook page, is Debiasing Training Improves Decision-Making in the Field. It's a recent paper, July 2019, in Psychological Science.
And I think one of the things that's so cool about that kind of research is that it's in games, you actually have to apply the knowledge. You right. don't just learn about it passively. And I think that active application, it can be really, really beneficial for learning.
Right. Another simple technique, and I'm wearing a rubber band on my wrist right now. I think this is from cognitive behavioral therapy, is when you think those certain thoughts or when you want to remind yourself, snap the rubber band.
I'd much rather play a video game. You know, a topic that Bob and I have covered before on this show, once or twice at least, is the, you know, the majority of states in the U.S. have adopted a common core standards, you know, for grades K through 12. And the Common Core State Standards Initiatives has a stated goal of developing the critical thinking, problem solving, and analytical skills students will need to be successful. You have a section for teachers on Clearer Thinking, and invite them to use some of those modules on that site. Can you describe how that works and the benefit to teachers in education?
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened is we kept having teachers saying, hey, I would like to use your modules with our students. How can I do that? And we would say, well, we're not really sure. So we ended up, through talking to teachers, we ended up developing a simple system where there's a section on our site for teachers. They can go in, they can pick all of the modules from any of our more than 30 modules that they want to assign to their students. And what we'll do, it will generate links that they can then give to their students. And then when one of the students completes one of the modules, the teacher will get an email saying, this student has completed the module, and so they can keep track of who has done what. And so it's a nice way to integrate our modules about all these different topics right into the classroom, and it can be used for high school students or college students or graduate students, any level.
Do you have any plans to sort of get into the educational part of that at a deeper level so that you're actually maybe presenting a customized set of tools just for that purpose?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, we make tools covering a really wide range of areas, so I think a lot of them are relevant at the high school and college level. But that being said, really our specialty is trying to make programs that are really good for a wide and general audience. So we're not focusing on planning to focus on college students or high school students per se.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back and spend a little more time with the specific tools and mini courses on clearer mm-hmm. thinking. So which ones do you think are especially important to help people improve their critical thinking tools for their toolbox?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm just pulling up the list because so many, it's hard to even keep in my mind all of them. So I recommend starting with the how rational are you really test, because it gets you thinking about different biases and how they apply to your life. And it gives you a customized report, sort of analyzing how susceptible you might be to different biases. So I think that's a really great place to start. Another one that's quite interesting is this program called the Belief Challenger. And this is one of the few ones where you actually published an academic study on that program, on the Belief Challenger program, where we actually get you to pick an important belief that you have that many other people disagree with, and we take you through a process of thinking about that belief and challenging it. And we found that it actually does adjust people, cause people to change their mind. Not that they completely flip their opinion, but it does get them to consider other opinions and kind of consider the other side of their belief. So I think that's a really good one for critical thinking. Then there's the program called the Question of Evidence, and that one teaches the principles of Bayesian thinking, which is what we were talking about before. So if you found that conversation interesting, I definitely recommend checking out the Question of Evidence program. And then another one, which is about overconfidence, is we actually have a few programs on overconfidence, but one of them that's one of my favorites is the Common Misconceptions Test. And so that can actually analyze whether you are being overconfident in your beliefs. And so that's pretty cool.
Can I give you a personal anecdote about the belief module there, the belief changer?
Please, yeah.
I don't want to get gruesome here, but I had a... A simple sort of basal cell thing removed from my face. It was pretty simple surgery. And the surgeon that did it recommended hydrogen peroxide to use on that wound as it was healing for about 10 days.
Ah.
And about 5 days into that, I did that module. And one of the beliefs that it was challenging is whether hydrogen peroxide is warranted, is good for healing wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so after I got done with the module, of course, being a skeptic and critical thinker, I did some research on the internet, and lo and behold, that's right. You're better off to use just water and stay away from alcohol unless there's an infection there. Stay away from alcohol and hydrogen peroxide. So the next time I saw that doctor, I actually asked him, and challenged him with that in a nice way. And he had a rationale for it. But, I think it caused him to think a little bit when I brought the articles in.
Oh, that's such a great story. I'm so glad that it had that effect. That's exactly what we're hoping for. Actually, to tell you a story of my own about that, we once had someone contact us very angrily. And they were a hedge fund manager and managed a lot of, large amount of money for people. And they took one of our programs, and the program analyzed their behavior in the program and told them that they're overconfident. And so the person sends us this angry email saying, "I'm not overconfident. Your program's totally wrong. This is ridiculous." And we're like, okay, whatever. So then about a month later, we get another email from this person, and they say, "You know what? I've thought a lot about it, and I realize I actually am overconfident. Your program's right. Thank you for teaching me that." And then we're like, whoa, wow. It seemed to actually sink home finally when they started thinking about it more in their daily life. So that's the stuff we love to hear.
That's a great testimonial.
Sounds like the kind of email an overconfident person would send.
Yeah, exactly. You're totally wrong. What are you talking about?
I'll throw a few more in the critical thinking toolkit here that I used. How well can you tell reality from BS?
Yeah, I enjoyed that one because
I thought that was excellent.
As a skeptical reasoning style, detecting BS was something apparently I'm good at, but it did make me think, how can other people learn that as a skill? Because it's something that's really important in every aspect of our life.
Yeah, and I want to say that these tools and modules, when you get done with them too, you can put in your email address and get a report, a detailed report that you can actually keep. And there's a lot of links, additional links to go on and use, beyond the module. And I thought that was good. I also think for critical thinkers, the intrinsic values module is a great one.
Glad you like that one. That's actually one of our newest ones, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, that made me ponder my values and understand intrinsic versus extrinsic a little better than I did. Let's see, what else? I think you mentioned most of the other ones.
Oh, so one of them that I like a lot, it's not as much in the critical thinking realm, but it's called Life-Changing Questions.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I did that one today.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So what we did, we actually ran a series of studies to try to figure out what open-ended questions do people find it most valuable to ponder. And so we started with hundreds of questions, and we ended up scientifically testing over 100 different questions where we'd have people answer them, and then we'd have them rate how valuable the experience was. And what that program is, Life-Changing Questions program, is it's just the questions that people found it most valuable to answer. And so it's a really fun experience to go through these questions and kind of ponder. Some of them are really big questions about, you know, the meaning of everything, and some of them are more micro questions about your own life. But I think people have gotten a lot out of that program.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one because it was very reflective and sort of introspective. And I also have to give you props for having a flexibility. You can kind of do it like the quick way. You can do it the short way, the quick way or the long way.
And you can do it with friends, too. We have a group mode.
Yeah, and then most of all, at the very, very end, it can remind you in, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months to return to those questions and those answers. I found it very a great sort of self-reflection.
Oh, great. I'm glad to hear that. And actually, there's another little cool feature at the end where you can send your answers to a friend or a family member. And then if they answer, they can send their answers back. So you can kind of do it in like a pen pal mode, and you can see each other's answers. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So give us your future dreams about your work using training and technology to make a better world.
Yeah. So something that I'm extremely excited about is trying to accelerate social science research, because my feeling is that so many of the important questions actually relate to social science, like how do we help people make better decisions? How do we make people happier? How do we reduce mental illness? And so these are a lot of the things that we try to work on. But my feeling is we just need more research. We need faster research, and we need it to be done more robustly. So we've been doing a lot of work on trying to accelerate social science research. And to do that, we've actually started building a bunch of new technology. So we built a platform for recruiting people for studies that makes it a lot faster. So if we need to find 120 people that have sleep problems, and we just split them into two groups and track them over time in order to build a sleep tool, we can do that. We also, one of the things I'm most excited about is we built a new technology platform called Guided Track, which is for building behavioral interventions. So all of the clear thinking programs that you see, they're built using this platform, Guided Track, and now we're opening it up to everyone so other people can build their own tools, whatever they're an expert in. They can kind of apply their expertise and create new behavioral interventions. So that's what gets me really exciting, is trying to create an explosion of new behavioral interventions and new social science.
I find that really interesting, and I'd love to dig into that a little bit more. Like myself, I've been trying to use sort of habit tracking, but the app itself isn't necessarily designed to change habits. It's just been a way for me to sort of keep track. Can you sort of go into what, for instance, you mentioned earlier, the Uplift app, or some of the other app solutions that you have, and how people can benefit from it?
Yeah. So Uplift is one that we spent years building. It's an app you can download the App Store. If you search Uplift for depression, and the goal is to try to give people the most evidence-based way to help their own depression. And so you mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy earlier. It's based on the principles of cognitive behavioral therapy. And for those who don't know, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT as it's sometimes called, is the most evidence-based treatment protocol for people suffering from depression. And so we actually, what we did is we tried to package these evidence-based techniques and give them to you in an app so you can apply them to your own life to try to help yourself. And so that's what Uplift is. And then we have another program called MindEase, which is the idea of that is to try to give you a way to manage your anxiety symptoms really effectively. So whenever you're feeling really stressed or anxious, you can open up the MindEase app, and it tries to help you in that moment. So those are just two examples. Another example that relates to what you're asking is on clearthinking.org, we have this program called Daily Ritual. I'm not sure if you checked that out. But what Daily Ritual is actually based on the large randomized control trial we ran. We tested many techniques to help get people to form new habits. And so actually, we recruited about 500 people. We asked them to pick a daily habit they wanted to form. And then we randomized them into different groups where many people would get five different techniques that they'd be assigned. at random out of a set of 22 different techniques we were testing. And then we would track them for a month to see who would stick to their habit. And remarkably, we found that one of these 22 techniques actually worked, seemed to work much better than the others, according to the results of the study. And that technique, we call it the habit reflection technique. And it's really simple, but powerful. The idea behind it is that you start by thinking about a habit that you've succeeded at forming in the past. So that's step one. And so once you have this habit you've succeeded at in the past, step two is you take a minute or two to write about what you did that you think helped you succeed at that past habit. You know, did you do the habit at a certain time every day? Did you ask friends or family to help you with the habit? Did you set reminders for yourself? Whatever it is that you think really helped you form the habit. And then step three, you then take another minute or two to write about how you could apply what worked for you in the past to this new habit you're trying to form. And we found in the study that this worked better than all the other 22 techniques we tested. And we actually built this, the results of this study, into this program called Daily Ritual. It's just free on our website, where you can actually apply it to your own habit and try to kickstart a new habit, whether it's exercising or, habits around socializing or habits around saving or all kinds of different things.
Yeah, I also wanted to dig in because I found this really fascinating when I listened to another podcast, the 80,000 Hours podcast you were on, and you were explaining how you've used online resources to make conducting experiments easier. I'm kind of hoping you could enlighten us a little bit about that because experiments can be very cumbersome to sort of pull together. And then in the process of doing them, you find that you want to have other experiments and whatnot. So how did you make that easier? And what are the benefits of that?
Yeah, well, so much of what we know about modern social science comes from conducting experiments. And so the easier and cheaper and faster we can make those, the more we can learn, and hopefully that will enable us to improve people's lives more. And so, yeah, this has been a really major focus of ours. How do we make experiments easier? And so we actually built this, we built technology for creating experiments. You can actually use it yourself if you want. It's free. It's called Guided Track. You go to guidedtrack.com and actually lets you build experiments. And that's what we use to build all of our experiments. And then we also build a platform for recruiting people for experiments or for studies in general. So that's called positly.com. You can actually use that now as well. So it's positly.com. And so those are actually two new platforms we created that are all about helping researchers create experiments and then recruit people for those experiments. So with the goal of helping you test things faster, cheaper, more easily, and hopefully answer more important questions about human beings. And then we also just think a lot about what are the ways to do good social science research to answer these kinds of questions. And so that's kind of another thing that is a major initiative of ours.
Yeah, it seems like that would contribute directly to the acceleration of social science understanding that you're talking about.
Very interesting part of what you do, I think, is this whole idea of speeding up research. But a part of research, doing good research in any of the sciences, is publishing. Publishing of research then gives a chance for people to critique your research and for science to adjust itself and for other people to get ideas about research. Have you had people that have used your methods and actually done publications after that?
Yeah. We've had quite a lot of those. And one thing that we've been doing is actually partnering with academics, where we'll be building a new behavior change program for clear thinking. And we'll collaborate with academics saying either we'll be basing it on some of their research, or we'll collaborate with them where they'll actually inject hypotheses into our programs that they can test, and then we'll give them the anonymized data and then they'll go write a paper. And so we've actually been having this happen where we'll kind of work with them and they'll publish academic papers based on kind of the programs we built. So that's been really cool. And then sometimes we're actually also doing our own studies. And just recently, we've been opening up our technology to academics more broadly and having them run whatever studies they want using our platform. So that's also been really exciting.
One of the other things I'd really like you to talk a little bit more about, because we talked about these modules and what they're meant to do, is the amount of work that you actually do. You don't just kind of wing it and intuitively come up with, well, this might work. Talk a little bit about how these modules are really developed and how you actually do quite a bit of background research on theory and a little bit about that.
Well, I have to say it's a ton of work to build one of these modules. So, you know, I'm really grateful to the ClearThinking team, who I work really closely with. And yeah, they put so much work into these. But basically, usually what will happen is we'll start with a handful of different ideas of, okay, what's a new module we can make? And we're really trying to ask the question, what would be really valuable to people? What do we think is a topic where we could make a best-in-class program that could benefit people? Either benefit their thinking or their decision making or their happiness. And then once we've kind of honed down on the idea we want to work on, we'll start by looking at the academic literature and saying, well, what's kind of known about this topic? What is kind of accepted? What are the different theories and hypotheses out there? And those are usually really informative to look at and give us a lot of good ideas. And in some cases, there will be a lot of evidence saying how exactly kind of the material should be taught. In other cases, there won't be as much evidence, and we have to do more interpretation of saying, well, there's different theories, and we have to think about these different theories. And then we will build a kind of a first draft of one of these programs, and then we'll actually start testing it on real people. And so that will go through various phases. We actually have thousands of people who have agreed to be beta testers for us, who, you know, our mailing list of users, about 70,000 people. And among those, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 have agreed to beta test our programs. And so we'll actually send early versions out to the 3,000 or 4,000 beta testers. And then they'll try the program and they'll give us tons of feedback, both quantitative, where we'll actually ask them to rate the program in lots of different ways, and qualitative, where they'll make qualitative suggestions of how to make it better. And we kind of go through this iteration process. And then more and more often, we've actually been then doing other studies of our own to kind of bridge the gap between where academia stops and the kind of applied programs we're building, because the academic theory doesn't necessarily answer all the questions we need to know in order to actually apply in the real world. So we might have to do a kind of study that kind of takes it to that final step, and then we can actually use that to inform the building of the program.
Has anyone, any academic or anyone in your group, monitored the people who have taken the module and kind of done an A/B study of some sort?
Yeah, for some of our modules, like, you know, it's a lot of work to do those studies, but so we can't do them in every case. But for example, in the Belief Challenger program, we actually did run a study on people using it, and we actually published an academic paper based on this, showing that it does shift people's beliefs. So that was really cool.
Can you give the citation for that? I'd like to.
I'll have to find it.
okay.
I think the paper is called "Nudging Resistors Towards Change," if I'm remembering it off the top of my head.
That'll
so you can
enough.
Search that. Yeah, it's one of our papers. So that's one. And then we did a big study, as I mentioned, on our daily ritual, which is our habit program. And we didn't publish that in an academic journal, but we did publish the results of that on our blog. And you can read all about the statistics from that study and what exactly we tested and how we tested it. And so that's all on our blog. And so more and more, we've been doing studies like that. And sometimes we'll submit them back in academic journals, but sometimes we'll just kind of put a thorough analysis on our blog, because it just takes a lot less time and it can still get out the information.
We've got about, 9 minutes or let's say about 7 minutes left in the show here.
Yeah. You always know we have a good show when there's no callers.
That's right.
Too intently listening.
yeah, that's fine. Because I have a question for you. It will only scratch the surface.
I was really hoping we'd save this for the last minute, but I guess we'll give them a few more minutes to answer.
Okay, so here's how it goes. And this is something I think a lot about. Do you think we're ever going to be able to create artificial intelligence that is free of human biases? And if so, that we'll actually be able to use those kinds of programs to supply us with unbiased analyses of issues to supplement our cognitive processing. In other words, you know, overcome our evolutionary system one and heuristical
thinking. This is the stuff that keeps Bob up at night.
Yeah.
Well, I love this question. I mean, both as someone who is obsessed with how do we think more clearly, but also as someone who has studied artificial intelligence, because my PhD was focused on AI and machine learning. And so I'm going to respond to this question from the point of view of the AI systems we have today, which are largely based on the field of machine learning. And one of the things to know about machine learning is that what these algorithms really do is they take data and they learn from it. They actually learn from examples, the way that a child might learn from examples, except it's a little bit different. It's, you know, numerical examples. But they're learning from examples. And the thing about learning from examples is that if there are biases in the examples you're learning from or from the data in the data itself, then the system that's learning will adopt those biases. And in fact, we have seen this happen on multiple occasions where a machine learning system actually ends up being biased in different ways because the data set is inherently biased that it's trained on. So an example of this is if someone is building a face recognition system, they need to give it lots and lots of examples of faces. And if there's a bias in those faces, for example, if there's some, let's say that data set doesn't have people of a certain ethnicity in it, then that algorithm will probably perform very badly on recognizing faces of that ethnicity because it doesn't have enough examples from that group. So another really fascinating example of this is when judges try to decide whether to give someone bail. Increasingly, they've been using algorithms that are called risk assessment algorithms that actually try to make a prediction about whether the person is someone that might disappear and not come back to court. And there's a debate going on about, well, these algorithms seem like they might be biased in certain ways. It's being debated. But one of the really interesting things to think about is, so algorithms can certainly have biases, and they tend to have the biases of the data that we give them by default. But humans also are very biased, as we know. And so one interesting question is, are these algorithms biased? But another interesting question is, well, how biased are they relative to human decision making? Because in some cases they might be biased, but they might be less biased than human decision makers. So while we want to eradicate bias as much as possible, we also have to take into account the fact that in real life, a lot of times people are dealing with biased humans. So, there's a trade-off there. So I think it's a really great and interesting question.
Yeah, it would be. And the reason I think about this is because often I get discouraged by seeing the amount of willingness to believe disinformation and the polarization that we're experiencing, fake news, all that kind of stuff. And I get a little bit discouraged that our biases are so entrenched and our emotion is such a big part of our belief system that it almost seems hopeless at times. And so I guess I'm hoping for a artificial intelligence that we can use to get an unbiased opinion so that it will be a challenge to our biases and we can trust that this mm-hmm. is an unbiased mm-hmm. belief or an unbiased slant on something or an unbiased decision or whatever. And we can then compare that with ourselves and that might kind of push us to rethink things a little bit. That's where I was going with that question.
Hopefully one day we will have that, but we're definitely not there yet.
Okay. When are you going to be there?
It's going to take a while.
I'm hoping you'll work on this.
Yeah.
I'm hoping you'll work
on this.
Bob,
you're getting pretty far out again.
I know. But, we're making a start on it. Spencer, do you know about the folks at No Hear News?
No, I don't.
Well, they're a group.
It's No Hear, like K-N-O-W.
Yes.
No
Hear News. And they're folks, a group of young folks who, again, are wanting to do something for the world. And they put together a news service using artificial intelligence to look at topical news stories and then rate different sources in terms of their reliability. And then put those together, and they sometimes, if it's a political issue and it's a left-right issue, they will boil it down to the left position and the right position.
And that's cool.
The AI algorithm gives this information to human beings, and then human beings write it into something that sounds like it wasn't written by a machine. So, but it's check it out. It's nohearnews.org, I think,
like,
or could be .com.
KNOWHERE. No Hear.
Yeah. Okay,
that sounds really great. Well, that reminds me. I subscribe to something called The Flip Side, which is just a daily news that summarizes the news from the left and right side by side, which I think is kind of fun.
And in some ways, that seems like a good route to go is to acknowledge the biases and put them in that context.
That's why I guess it's good to hear people in debate with both sides coming out. And I love it when our newscasts give both sides mm-hmm. or the multitude of sides. Well, we got about, let's say, 30 seconds, a minute left here. Spencer, can you tell us a little bit about any kind of things that you'd like us to post links to on the Facebook page that we have, or how our listeners can use your work?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun. I definitely suggest your listeners check out clearthinking.org. We've got over 30 free tools that we talked about many of them tonight, but you can play around with them. We've got our app Uplift. If you or someone you love is feeling depressed, you might want to try that out. It's on the app stores. Just search Uplift for depression. Or if you suffer from anxiety, check out Mind Ease, which is also on the app store. And yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've got a couple admirers here in the K-Mud studio.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Spencer Greenberg, whose work includes implementing the startup foundry organization called SparkPlug and the teaching training Clearer Thinking website. Check it out. And also thanks to our engineer, Mitch. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And remember,
keep thinking
clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.